You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
You know, I wrote a book to address precisely this question, and I had to ask myself, what is really impossible? If you watch Harry Potter and you watch a magic show, is it possible that you can take a rabbit out of a hat with nanotechnology, create all sorts of life forms just by thinking about it? And then you begin to realize that very few things are actually impossible.
But wait a minute. When you say very few, you really mean nothing.
Almost nothing.
No, no. If you say almost, give me an example of something that is impossible.
So let me ask this to both of you, because it seems like the same feeling of awe that drives you to be excited about either Star Trek or the blues or writing, and for you, physics, it's that's what keeps you going.
That's what my book is all about.
Right, so what I do appreciate is it's sort of like you guys have the ignition key turned on of that sense of awe.
That's it.
So I am so excited to have William Shatner on the show. And William Shatner just came out with a book, Live Long and ... What I Learned Along the Way.
You got it.
Do you like Bill?
What?
Will? Bill? Will?
Bill.
Bill, I can't believe you're 87 years old.
I can't believe it either. It makes two of us.
Does it feel like, do you wake up and say to yourself, you know, I'm going to ask your wife, Elizabeth, actually. Does he say, I feel like I'm 25. What am I doing in this 87-year-old body?
He doesn't need to say anything. He just acts like
25. how does he act that way? How does he act that way? Does he jump out of airplanes still or anything?
Well, he would if there was one available, I'm sure. But no, he just gets up and gets thinking about things, and it's blast off.
So you mentioned several. I feel like there's a lot of things I want to cover about the book and about your life, but really, the most compelling thing for me is
you're going strong at 87. I don't mean this like in an insulting way or whatever.
I don't take it as an insult.
Like, it seems like a big part of your life philosophy is don't die.
Well, all the 87-year-olds I know are dead.
Well,
they didn't follow my advice. I kept telling them, don't die. And they died.
Yeah, they made that mistake. And what do you think was the, as you've seen them die, what do you think was the critical mistake they made?
They died.
I know they die, but why?
That's the eternal question. Religions have been based on why.
But I feel like
I can't answer why. Why did they die? They changed their mind about living, okay? Somewhere along in their body, in their mind, they said, it's time to turn off. But or something said turn off.
I think that's right, though. I think you almost make not quite a semi-conscious decision. It's sort of like you quoting George Burns in the book and saying, as long as I'm booked, I'll stay alive.
Right.
And well, I feel like you have the same philosophy. I think you're afraid almost to not say yes to things because then you'll die.
Well, I was...
I'm getting right into it.
I had my cheek on the body of my beloved dog who was dying on the kitchen floor. My wife and I, we were keening over him, and he had waited for me to come out from out of town, and he's lay on the floor. He's waiting for me, we think. And I lay down beside him, and I saw his eyes glaze over, and I put my hand on him. Then his eyes opened up, and I said, I'm here. And he kind of weakly, and then he started to die again. And I said, don't die now. And he kind of woke up a little bit, and then he went, and he died right there. He died waiting for me. He decided, I'm stiff, I'm old, it's time to go. My poop doesn't come out anymore. It's enough already. I heard his jokes so many times. It's time to go. And my beloved dog died in my arms. He decided to go. Okay? That's the way it's going to be.
So it seems like the way you decide not to go, and you mentioned it in various ways in the book, is, you know, you love your work. You're never going to retire. So you're always finding new things to do, new things to say yes to.
Which, by the way, I want to talk to you about new albums and books and tours and things.
Tell me. So what are you saying yes to at the age of 87?
I'm saying yes. Look, I've got a country music album. It's great. It's a great country music album. It's getting great reviews. Like, this is my favorite song. That's my favorite song. People are loving it. I loved doing it. Did it with Jeff Cook of the group Alabama, and it's terrific. I did the Nashville scene. I recorded in Nashville. I used Nashville people to write the songs. I chose the songs. I got the order of the song. It's fantastic. Why Not Me is the name of the album based on one of the songs in the album. I was asked to do a Christmas album, calling it Shatner Claus. Funny song, funny title, hopefully catchy enough to attract your attention. But there's some really serious material in the Christmas album in which I try to fuse the spoken word with music as best I can. I'm learning how to do it, and I'm getting better and better at doing it. So if you were to listen to the albums, you'd see what it is I'm trying to do. And then this book is getting great notices, and people are enjoying it. So there's these three things, too. Then I'm on tour with a film called The Wrath of Khan, which is one of the Star Trek films, and they play the film, and I come on stage for an hour and talk and entertain and talk about the film or not. And then I'm going to Australia. I did a one-man show in New York a few years ago and toured that and around the States. And I'm going to Australia to tour that and New Zealand in October. And then I'm planning, they want me to do a blues album. And I'm intrigued by the blues. Now, the blues, the way, what's her name done it? Just died.
Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin. She breathes the note, and the note comes out like she sang it when she was two in the Baptist church. That's part of her DNA. It's not part of my DNA. I have to acquire it. But how do you acquire blues when you don't sustain a note? Like one of the songs in the country music album is I Should Have Loved Her. And the guy who demonstrated the song, it's right out of the Brill Building. Do you remember anything about the Brill Building in Times Square where they would play the piano and there would be a songwriter in each of the offices of the Brill Building in Times Square? And on a warm summer's day, you would hear cacophony of piano players playing their songs for Al Jolson and Cantor and all those people. Those people, the facility has moved to Nashville, and there are all these writers in Nashville demonstrating their songs. So they demonstrated their songs to me by phone, electronically. I picked this one, I picked that one. Then I had their performance on my phone, which I learned, and there is this song with the guy sustaining the note, I should have loved, and he sustains the note, loved. And you realize the anguish. I did this, I did that, but what I should have done is, I should have loved. So and he sustains the note. How do you do that with the spoken word? That was the question. And then you'll listen to what I do with it.
So you take, will you take like voice lessons?
No, no, it's the meaning. It's the meaning of the song that I aim for. It's the spoken word while doing the music at the same time. I'm trying a new genre, if you will, or
yeah,
another genre with some variations on it.
Well, it seems like that's the story of this great adventure you've been on since you were 6 years old on your first radio show.
That's exactly right. Thank you for saying that.
So again, like, you know, on the one hand, you admit you've been very fortunate, but on the other hand, you have this philosophy, which I'm really curious about, of repeatedly saying yes.
And well, the book, Live Long and Ellipse, which the ellipse is the balancing point. Live long, yes, you can do that. But what are you going to do with those three dots? How are you going to make your decisions based on those three dots? Because those three dots are critically important. Live long and what are you going to do? Are you going to say yes to life, which is what the book advocates? Say yes to life.
But how do you know what to say? I feel like if I said yes to Australia, New Zealand,
yeah,
back to Nashville,
yeah,
let's drive to Joliet in a blizzard,
I would be dead already.
You did it. I
know. I did with a good baseball.
Into January 2016.
Exactly.
How do you learn what to say yes to?
Well,
you obviously love many things.
Well,
you love doing many things.
But you, the other part of that is nothing is for sure. I know, I sense that when I walk out that door, I'm going to be hit by a car, okay? I'm going to die the moment I leave here. The last thing you'll hear me say is, live long and bang, and I hit by a bus.
This podcast would be huge.
It'd be viral.
If that happened.
So you, in your most intimate of minds, you wish that would happen.
No.
Well, secretly.
Yeah.
Secretly. If he only died when he left this building, I would have this biggest podcast and all those people who got me to sign an autograph, double their money immediately.
Uh-huh.
And if you hold on to it longer, maybe triple. You know?
Well, you mentioned how less people started asking you for your autograph.
More and more. And I'm thinking, why are they doing that? Uh-huh. And then I realize it's because they think he's going to die. And I'm going to fool them. I'm not going to die. And the autograph will be worthless.
That's sort of like, actually, just, this is on a weird tangent, but people used to buy the life insurance policies in the early 90s of AIDS victims. And then all those life insurance policies became worthless because essentially AIDS was prolonged forever.
Oh, right. Oh, interesting. But would an insurance company write an insurance policy?
Yeah.
An AIDS victim?
Yeah. It was.
That's a precondition.
They would write it and then the person would find out he had AIDS. And so they would be.
Oh, you mean they would say the person.
And so like a billionaire would say, hey, I'll give you this in advance so you can enjoy your life.
Oh, and your policy.
Yeah. And they would buy it at a discount.
Did that really happen?
Yeah. But
My
then
God,
they all lost money.
That's worse than hyenas feasting on a body.
Yeah. But they all lost money anyway because the AIDS cocktail started, you know, HIV cocktails.
Right.
So anyway, on a tangent, but...
No, but a neat tangent.
Yeah.
We talked about hyenas feasting on a body. What could be better?
Yeah, exactly.
It's stand-up comedy. So saying yes, you don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work. Same as stand-up comedy. You're going to tell a joke. I was asked years and years ago, do a stand-up routine. I thought, well, you know what I'll do? I've always admired. Stand-up is the purest form of artistry that I know of. It is a great stand-up comic is the great artist, in my opinion. So I thought, what would happen if Captain Kirk, I'm the captain of the universe, and I'm going to do stand-up comedy. And I come out, and I'm Captain Kirk, and I'm doing Henny Youngman, Take My Wife, Please. You know, do all the old things. Nothing works for Captain Kirk. Is that a funny concept?
That is a funny concept. So you tried it,
and it didn't work. But, and I'm watching the head of it was the comedy club, or there was one guy, the sensational guy who fathers all the stand-up comics. There's this heavyset guy who's like the father of all the, who was...
like Dangerfield or...
No. It was the owner of the premises whose place, the comedy club, it was his comedy club.
Uh-huh.
There's a famous guy. Well, he was there.
Manny Dorman on the Comedy Cellar downtown?
No.
Jamie Masada.
Who?
At the
it could have been. Anyway, the owner of the comedy club I'm in New York, in Los Angeles.
Sure. Who is Mitzi Shore's husband?
There you go. That's guy.
He'll look it
okay,
up.
So say it's like Mitzi Shore. So she's standing there watching me do this thing. So I'm the Captain Kirk saying all these stock, non-funny jokes. And I think, that's going to be funny. Here is the captain of the Enterprise thinking that he's going to try and be a stand-up comic, and he fails, and that's funny.
That does sound funny, actually.
Right. It wasn't. I didn't do it right, or it wasn't funny. And I'm there saying these stupid jokes, and people are looking at me like, what is he doing?
But them looking at you asking, what is he doing, that's funny.
That's right. That was my... esoteric take on what I was doing. But I was watching Shore's husband not looking too pleased.
I bet you if that
his
was
mouth
now
turned when, down.
I bet you that would be a viral YouTube video. That would be huge. Well, that would be like you reading
gone.
Sarah Palin.
It's long gone, and I'm not about to do it again. But it was really embarrassing. I got up there and I thought, that could be, along with many others, the most embarrassing moment of my life.
But it sounds like even from the beginning, from the early 60s to now, you have, you not only did have a reputation of doing this, you do this, you say yes to so much. Like, I still can't imagine what you just said, going to Australia, then New Zealand, then recording a blues album, then whatever the next thing and the next thing is.
Yeah, but look what's happening. So I've just told you about a failure. And that failure, because I'm enamored of stand-up comedy, and I watch a lot of stand-up comedy that's been recorded. I watch it avidly, and I'd sometimes play it 2-3 times, see what the guy is doing. The magic of telling a joke, and especially a political joke, a joke that's topical. So the guy's not only being political and humorous and funny, because he's making a comment, and it's on many levels. But comics make mistakes all the time. They tell a joke that really isn't funny, or they go over the... We've seen a lot of those cases where they've gone over the line. As somebody said to me when they made a joke about something too soon, and it was too soon, they were not funny, and they got castigated for it, really ripped. So... comics make mistakes all the time in fashioning a comedy routine. Well, I'll throw that joke out. That didn't work, and that's too long. I'll edit that down. That's the way you perfect your comedy routine, by making mistakes. That's the way you got to live your life, by saying yes, tell the joke, it doesn't work, forget the joke.
So what would you say no to now? It doesn't sound like you would say
stand-up
no.
Stand-up comedy.
That's a good bit. What would you say... what would you actually say no to in terms of, like, if someone said, you know, hey, Bill.
Give me a crazy suggestion.
We want you to do a five-season commitment on a reality show.
Yes, but I'll only appear occasionally.
Okay. So you compromise. You have negotiations.
Well, hey, five seasons. You may be watching my death throes. You know, let's film your death throes. Oh, it hurts. That's good. Do it again. Oh, it hurts. No, a little louder.
Okay, we want you to do a world tour around the world twice, and say every 60 cities in the United States, then 60 cities in Europe, then 80 cities in Russia.
And I'm talking to the producer.
Yeah.
Listen, producer. There aren't that number of cities in the world, okay?
All right.
So you're obviously nuts. So you, I'm not going to say yes to.
Right. So, and even in the beginning of your career, it seems like you were known. I mean, you were known for saying you were on so many things. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Outer Limits,
Twilight Zone. I was making a living. I had three kids to put through school.
And then,
don't forget that there is a handful of actors who make these multitude of millions of dollars for standing around 6 months at a time while they make an epic film. And they get these $20, $30, $40, $50 million. You don't have to make many of them before you can retire and not worry about paying the rent. The rest of us, even though we're names, have a standard of living that needs to be, they would like it to be maintained, which requires them to work. So you have to get a job. You have to do the movies. You got to do the smaller movies. You do the television show. You go on location someplace you'd rather not go because the money is good. That's a very important part of what actors, except for that handful, do. So, I mean, I watched a movie on the airplane coming into New York from Los Angeles called Rampage. It's the worst movie I've ever seen. That is, why would that star do that movie, right? And there are these animals from old Japanese films that you can't kill them. It's bizarre. It's stupid. And why did he do it? Why did he do it? I don't know why he said yes to that. He's also a producer of it, so maybe that's why he said yes to that. But it's a dumb, and I knew it was going to be dumb. And I watched, I said yes to watching it because I wanted to see a dumb movie that I hadn't made.
So let's actually take one of these things you said yes to, which is obviously Star Trek, this weird show, weird
exactly.
science fiction show that no one knew whether or not it was going to be a success. Like day one, did you guys look around at each other and say, this is going to flop? Like, what were you thinking
well,
day
imagine,
one?
Well, imagine, take any alien, you know, that we meet during the week, and you think, that is, I don't know about that one. On the other hand, there were moments when you play split personalities or old versions or double versions. There were some, usually the mix was intriguing as hell. Something that no actor would be asked to play except on a science fiction show, in which I don't think there were any or many. And it was novel and it was interesting. And they were asking me to do things that I never even thought of, but how would you do that? What would you do? And you have to do it quickly. You have to do it now, like you and I are talking. You got to be there in that moment. There's no time to prepare. Let's see you. And let me look that up. And what do you think? There's none of that. It's you put on a wardrobe and you go. And you're there doing it spontaneously, like we are. So that's like intriguing. And you do 3 years of that. You think, well, all right. So some of the stupid dialogue, nobody will never understand. You try and memorize it, but
okay. So then, were you guys surprised when it was canceled?
No, we were being canceled every year.
Really?
We were being canceled every year.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Every year after the first year, there was a pseudo write-in campaign, and they were canceling and they weren't canceling. I don't know how true that is. And the third year, we limped along Friday nights.
Were the ratings like not good, or what was the?
We were like in the 40s. Like we were 40th. Or 45th, so just not over the line to be canceled, but not good enough to renew. And we were in the nether world, and it came to an end on the third season.
And so at the end, you know, you didn't necessarily have a next thing lined up. You were basically, this is what I don't understand. I think a lot of people don't know this. You were basically living out of a truck to support yourself.
Well, it's not quite as bad as that. it was bad. I was, they didn't pay us that well.
Well, what's the economics of that? Like now, TV, a guy in a main primetime TV show would be making, you know, over $100,000 an episode.
Right. 1/20th of that was a fair salary for a lead on a television show. And no residuals because it was prior to the union realizing, hey, wait a minute, they're playing these all the time and nobody's getting paid. So 2, 3, 4 years later, residuals, the actors were getting residuals. But our cast never got a penny for all the billions of dollars that the studios made. But saying yes to the various things in your life is critically important. So these albums are critically important to perfecting what it is you want to do. You have to fail the joke. was what I say. And the other thing I wanted to say is I'm on tour. Go to williamshatner.com and you'll find it when I'm in a city next to you. And one of the things that I do a lot of is bicycle, electric bicycle. So I said yes to an electric bicycle company, Pedego. And my family and I do a lot of bicycling with electric bikes. And that has brought the family together because I can keep up with the hot dog 13-year-old.
But when you were at this low point, though, like after Star Trek was canceled, how did you kind of come, like, were you depressed? Like, how did you come back from?
Well, so I didn't have any money.
What was the low point?
A $15 check I couldn't cash. And then I thought, well, I'll go on summer tour. So I put together a summer package for a dinner summer theaters back east. I had a truck. I put a cab on the back of the truck, took my dog, and I drove across the country. I toured these 13 weeks, lived in the back of the thing, hooked up to the theater hose and plug. I'd been a star in Star Trek, and I was living in the back of the truck. And then I drove back across the country to
and
get
what
home.
Were you doing? Like, what were you doing on tour?
I did A Girl in My Soup. I did this one set, funny Broadway comedies that were all the rage at the time.
So you would like be an actor in them? Or?
Oh, yeah. I produced, directed, and acted in them. And I usually had somebody else with a name value as well.
And then at what point did you realize, wait a second, there's somehow this is coming back. Like Star Trek is starting to get this, become this phenomenon.
About 6 years later, 5-6 years later, I'm skiing in a ski area up in Los Angeles, Mammoth, and somebody comes up to me and says, have you been to the bar? So I said, I know. Well, they're playing this funny film of you. What the hell are you talking about? And I go down to the bar and they're playing what were excerpts. I forgot what they call them. But the editors had put together all the foolish things that I had been doing, banging into doors and making jokes and things like that. And Roddenberry had sold these films that were made for the cast for Christmas parties. He was selling them, making us look like the fool, but he was making money on it. And I thought, why would anybody want to watch that 6 years later? And then the calls started to come. We're thinking of doing this, doing that, doing this. And finally,
so did that trigger like basically everybody wanting to replay the original episodes, like just Roddenberry's collection of bloopers?
I think it was more businesslike than that. I think they discovered that by playing an episode of Star Trek at a proper hour at a local station, the numbers told them that people were watching. And so then they played more and more people were watching. And then they realized that there was interest, that the American audience had a deeper interest in this thing called Star Trek. And then when Star Wars came about, the people at Paramount thought, well, we've got this Star Trek. Let's see if we can do that. And so they made a big movie, and it failed.
The first movie, but it still was big enough that they kept making more movies.
Well, Robert Wise was one of the big directors at the time, and he directed that film. And so it got a lot of publicity. It didn't actually fail. It was not a great movie, but it wasn't terrible.
So I just want to mention Michio Kaku is here.
No.
Yes.
What's Michio doing here?
Say hello, Michio. William Shatner.
Where are you?
Right here.
I interviewed Michio. You know that for a wonderful half hour show that we did. You remember that?
Michio's been on the podcast.
I know. I said yes to doing a show about the universe, and I ended up interviewing Stephen Hawking. I may have been his last interview, and had dinner with him, as a matter of fact. Had dinner with Stephen Hawking in Cambridge, all as a result of you saying yes to letting me interview you.
Well, Michio, what did Bill ask you on the interview?
Oh, he's interviewed all the time. Why would he remember an innocuous question by little old me?
Do you want to come up and maybe ask a question? Yeah, Jake, do we have audio on him?
Maybe he has. He's one of them. Thanks.
Okay. All right.
We can share this.
Mitchell, you can stay right here for a second.
Yes. Hi.
Hello, my friend. How are you? You're beautiful. Yeah. I love this man.
Mitchell, good to see you again.
He's a great scholar.
Uh-huh. Oh, here, we'll use... Yeah. There you go. So
So I have a Star Trek question for both of you.
Yeah?
So the transporter, you say it's potentially possible decades down the road through quantum entanglement. Did you ever think when you were doing Star Trek that some of this technology would be real? Like even now, you know, our phones now are better than the phones used in Star Trek.
Absolutely. Quantum physics hadn't been discovered, or maybe it had been 50 years ago.
It was still primitive, our understanding of the atom.
There was a concept of quantum physics, but they hadn't made it popular, the discoveries of what we now know and the little I know about quantum physics. Michio knows so much more. But what we now know is that quantum is so mysterious, so bizarre. The laws governing quantum don't seem to, although I think, and I'd like to ask you this question, that everything is a whole. Everything is united in one of this universe or the 11 others, that everything is unified. We're all one thing. So that the laws that seem to be not answering Newtonian laws, quantum physical laws, don't seem to be under the same rules as Newtonian laws, must be, because you can't have that conflict. Matter and antimatter would destroy each other. So what is bizarre is to our little innocent human eyes. What is working is what gentlemen, a great physicist like he, will discover, or his students will discover, the unifying laws of nature. And even then, we won't understand it.
By golly, I think he's got it. I think he's got it, folks. Let's give him a hand.
That was part of my stand-up comedy routine.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know, when you want the best of anything, You have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Well, as Einstein once said, the more we learn about the quantum theory, the more we realize that it's correct, and the more we realize how weird it is. It is a very weird theory, except it's just the way the world is. Get used to it.
So you once proposed that potentially the transporter, which, you know, beam me up, Scotty, you know, they transport something from a planet to the ship. You once proposed that the idea of quantum entanglement, observing quanta here, will affect quanta here, will be the way, the mechanism of that teleportation.
Well, in principle, we cannot teleport individual atoms. We can actually teleport into space.
I thought they could send one molecule from one post to the other. I heard that they had been able to do that.
Well, atoms, photons, rubidium, cesium atoms, they've been able to do. Next will be to the moon. Once we have a moon base, we're going to teleport to the moon.
Here's the question I have. Is it the same atom or just something that atomically is the same? It's still alive. If you were alive here, are you alive here in the new place?
Well, it's the information content. So it's not really the atom itself. You're creating a carbon copy of the original atom.
So the original guy died.
Yeah, sorry about that. The original Captain Kirk has to die to resurrect him someplace else. Sorry
the reality
about that.
Of it, there's two voices here. You've got the theory and the reality. The reality is that our atoms, molecules, us, the essence of what we are, is so complicated, is so beyond our ability to understand, let alone replicate, that it is... At this point, till the seas inundate us in the next 100 years, we will not be able to do that. So yes, the fun of saying the Star Trek mysticism, warp speed and teleportation and mental, well, I don't know about the mental, but all these mechanical things would be possible theoretically. Possible. You need the energy of the universe to do warp speed. Harness that, if you will.
Yeah. No, when I was a grad student at Berkeley, Star Trek just came out. And a lot of us PhD students in physics, we were mesmerized. We were like stuck on that TV screen watching it. And then we would pick it apart. Scene for scene, we would pick it apart using our understanding of quantum physics.
See, here is what the problem, what you're addressing in the problem with people like Meteo. They're storytellers. They are as much into science fiction as science fiction writers. What a science fiction writer can imagine, these guys imagine. Imagine a whirlpool of energy. Just imagine. And then maybe two whirlpools and they join up. And they're speculating on what if, what would happen if. Now, let me assemble some facts and I'll buttress my theory with a few mathematical principles that I half believe anyway, and I'll do something called string theory that I don't know quite, but I'll put it out there anyway because it's good fun and it'll make me... So people have all these imagined wonderful ideas, which are probably true because quantum is so weird that anything we can imagine isn't anywhere near as weird as what really is out there.
So I'm wondering, did the science fiction always lead the science, or did the science ever lead the science fiction?
Ah.
I think there's a synergy there. One leads to the other and back and forth. They cross-fertilize each other. Some of the greatest scientists of all time were fans of science fiction.
And some of the greatest science fiction writers were scientists.
That's right. Evan Hubble of the Hubble Space Telescope. He read Jules Verne as a child and quit being a country lawyer, got his PhD in astronomy, and went on to discover the Big Bang.
All these guys, everyone that I interviewed, led by him, are mysticists. They operate in the mystical area of what if. And because they're romanticists about their work and the universe and the possible... I mean, just think. The universe is theoretically 13.8 billion years old, and it's still expanding. So the mystery is, where is it expanding to? We think the limitation of space, we don't know. There are no limitations. We can't fathom a four-room wall without four walls. It doesn't exist in our imagination. There has to be an end. There's no end.
So it seems like there's a similarity in that this philosophy of what if applies not only to science, but the way you both live life, the way you explore your topics of the future of humanity, the way you explore
life,
you know, life itself. Like, you're doing a blues album, you're going to Australia, you're doing one-man shows all over the place.
But all the time, I'm aware that we have this window in which we are born and die, and we can view the majesty of what's out there and what's in here, and look with awe and wonder at it all.
Yeah.
And have a moment that he contributes to some of our knowledge, and then it's on to the next
See,
person.
What I do for a living is I work in something called string theory. That's my day job. And in string theory, we work in 11-dimensional hyperspace. Now, I realize that every day I work in things that 10, 20, 30 years ago was considered science fiction and preposterous. And now it's the center of gravity of theoretical physics. You cannot go to a physics conference without bumping into people working on string theory, hyperspace, the multiverse. That's where the action is. And just
and
a few decades...
And all the words literally come from Star Trek.
Well, yes and no.
A lot of it. The inspiration, sure.
Inspiration, absolutely. All these...
The multiverse.
Many of these guys, these wonderful scientists who are artists in their... not in their way, they are artists, were stimulated by grotesque stories that were told by Star Trek. And as kids, they looked at it and thought, wonder if I could be a star man, and what is out there, and what is that whirling thing? I'm going to get a magnifying glass and look at, and it turns out to be a huge telescope. And then Hubble says, we're going to put a, we'll get a telescope up there, and then, oh my God, somebody didn't think of the change inches to meters. It's diffused. We've got to send individuals up there to correct the focus of the Hubble friggin' star telescope. And they do. Guy goes in there and adjusts the little thing, and now we can see it more clearly. And then we see the majesty of the eagle cloud, and that's how stars are born. And we're looking on. We're being told fairy tales by these fairy tales tellers who are based on fact. But what we have to know, and a huge argument I got into with one of them, was dark matter. Dark matter and dark energy are 95 to 98% of the universe. And we don't know what it is. We just know that something strange is out there that is altering the physical principles by which things should happen, and things aren't happening the way. So we now know, or we think we know, that 97% of the universe, we have no idea what's happening. So I said, how with that 3% of knowledge that you have, are you making any observations whatsoever? How do you know the speed of light is constant when we don't know 97% of what you're looking at?
Yeah, Michio, how do we know?
Well, you know, he's right. Every high school textbook is being rewritten right now, because every high school textbook in astronomy
in many parts of the country, but not in some parts of the country.
Well, you know, the universe is made out of atoms, they say, but that's not true. Most of the universe is not made out of atoms. Only 4% is made out of hydrogen and helium in the higher
elements.
How does
he know that when 97% is blinding?
Yeah, that might be a law of the universe, just like we're folded inside of it.
Right. You know, I wrote a book called Physics of the Impossible to address precisely this question. And I had to ask myself, what is really impossible? If you watch Harry Potter and you watch a magic show, is it possible that you can turn, you know, take a rabbit out of a hat with nanotechnology, create all sorts of life forms just by thinking about it? And then you begin to realize that very few things are actually impossible. That if you look at nanotechnology...
But wait a minute. When you say very few... You really mean nothing.
Almost nothing.
No, no. If you say almost, give me an example of something that is impossible. Define almost.
It's the conservation of matter and energy. We see no violation of it. And even in hyperspace, even in string theory obeys the conservation of matter and energy. And
you mean the conversion from matter to energy?
That's right.
To energy?
You conserve. The total amount of matter and energy is constant. Even though they can go back and forth, the total amount of both is constant.
How do we know that for sure?
Well, every time we've measured it, it works out.
Because we're using the same measurements. You're looking at the same facts. What if the facts are different because of 97%? You don't know what it is.
I'm going to get back to the transporter. Like, how do they transport down without like nuclear explosions happening, because that seems to take a lot of energy?
Well, we've already teleported individual atoms, photons. Next, we're going to teleport to outer space. As soon as we get a moon base operating, we're going to teleport objects to the moon. However, larger molecules are very hard to teleport, okay? Teleporting Captain Kirk, that is something.
That's a pretty large molecule right there.
Maybe in the 23rd century.
Are we going to teleport energy? Are we going to send energy to the moon?
We're going to send the information content.
But we can't send energy itself?
No, we don't send energy itself. We send the information content.
But can't you send a light beam that can be converted to energy?
Yeah, but we want to do it instantaneously, and we want to do it across the universe.
Well, right. Well, but the photon will eventually reach the end of the
universe. In a few million years, maybe.
Right. Well, apparently, that's what it's going to take.
Right. But, you know, if you go into hyperspace, perhaps you can get around that.
And well, then there's hyperspace, and then there is the possibility that it's all circular, and that since gravity bends light, that the light over there is actually coming from there, and it's doing a circuitous route, and it's all circular. So we may be going in a circle. So if it's there and I'm here and you can bring space to you, that's hyperspace.
And so I think that's how you explain the warp drive, well, right?
No, that's one method of warp drive.
If the universe is circular, the farthest object in the universe is the back of your head.
Right.
The telescope would see the back of your head because light would go completely around the universe. However, we tried to measure the sides of the universe, and the universe seems to be near infinite. So we don't think the universe is circular. But if it was, the farthest object in the universe would be at the back of your head.
Yeah, but you see how fallacious that is. You're looking in that direction, and you're looking at light. Light is bent by gravity. So the light you're looking at may be over there. But you're saying, okay, I'm looking in that direction, but the back of my head is where the... But you don't know, because we don't. We know the photon bends around gravitational force and eventually reaches us. So maybe it's not 13.8 years that way. It may be, if you take Waze instead of the highway, you're going along the Waze route, and it seems like from this point to that point is a long distance, but if you had the highway, you'd be there in no time.
So let me ask this to both of you, because it seems like the same feeling of awe that drives you to be excited about either Star Trek or the blues or writing, and for you, physics, that's what keeps you going.
That's what my book is all about. The fact that you brought a great physicist here to inspire us with what he knows, and he's just giving you tidbits that are commercially that everybody can understand, but what he understands and what he is thinking is so far beyond anything we can think. What he imagines, his lifetime is, his brain is operating on a different level than ours. Not necessarily better, but a different level. He's imagining things that we can't imagine, or he's difficult to explain to dummies like us, but he can to his peers. But what is in common is the awe and the wonder of the universe and our inability, seemingly, to understand it.
Like you said before, it's storytelling. And you've said you have to be able to really know something. You have to be able to explain it to a three-year-old. So it's all storytelling at some point to kind of get that awe, to get that expertise.
Well, look at what the storytelling is. There were the fables, the fairy tales, but the fairy tales contained a truth. And so when Hans Christian Andersen talked about the wolf and the Red Riding Hood, and there were messages there that were hidden behind the folds of the red cloak and the basket, and there when Hansel and Gretel were pushed in the oven, I mean, they're based on all those fairy tales of antiquity. There were fears and dreams and hopes of humanity involved in those fairy tales that people told around the fireplace because there was no television. Now we have the new fairy tales, which are when the great physicist Stephen Hawking says on one pronouncement, all information on the event horizon goes into the black hole and never comes out. It all disappears. And a few years later, he says, yeah, it comes out. I don't know how it comes out, but it comes out. He's changed his mind because based on further observation or further thinking, he's changed his mind. So it's a fairy tale.
Right, but it reminds me of Star Trek, you know, to go where no man has gone before. This is at the fringes of science, at the fringes of...
He's working on the fringes of the fringes.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, these stories have religious, theological implications. When I was a child, I realized that my parents were Buddhists, and in Buddhism, there is no God, there's no beginning, there's no end, there's just nirvana. But I was raised as a Presbyterian, in which case there is a God, there is a story about Genesis, and God says, let there be light. So I had these mutually contradictory ideas in my head all my life. But you see, with string theory, we can now meld these two parables into one coherent theory that our universe did have a big bang. Our universe did have an instant of creation like Genesis, but it's a bubble, and it's a bubble that coexists with other bubbles. And what is it floating in? Nirvana. So there is a nirvana.
So now we hear of a great scientist whose traditions... the way he was brought up affect the way he thinks, Presbyterian and Buddhist. I admire both of those philosophies, especially Buddhism, which has a transcendence of our human body and everything is forever in Buddhism. But he's affected by his upbringing. He can't escape the earthly, cloying fingers of his upbringing. And so he's uniting two philosophies that may or may not exist. Okay? So Big Bang is wonderful, but it only came into being, the theory only came into being, what, 20 years ago, 50 years ago?
In the 1930s, it really took off.
80 years ago, somebody said, you know, Big Bang, oh my God, you know, tectonic plates. Well, of course, tectonic plates, you idiot. Only came into being, what, 30 years ago. I mean, all these new theories, they're, well, of course you evolve. I mean, if you don't evolve, you die, and then you don't evolve. And that which evolves lives. I mean, it's like one and one.
But some things, it feels like some things we definitely know. For instance, we know how a car drives. We can make a car that drives, and everybody around the world will make this, roughly the same kind of car to drive the same way. Some physics we understand, but it still seems like on the fringes, like the Enterprise would go where no man has gone before. You're going in your research where no man has gone before, but everything in there, we sort of know. It's not total story.
No, we don't.
how do you feel about him saying that?
We know nothing, okay? We don't know anything because Big Bang came 80 years ago. 80 years ago, my lifetime,
yeah.
Okay? Somebody said, I got a theory of how this all came about from this fine, infinitely pinpoint of energy. This thing exploded and became our universe. It's great. It's romance. It's got beauty. It's got the theory is there's a word for it that has a beauty to it. It's synchronicity. It takes in everything. It's beautiful. It's a concept that these minds can grasp and say, that is perfect. That's a perfect scientific theory. But it only came in 80 years ago. What's going to happen tomorrow?
Well, what do you think? He's saying basically everything is story.
Everything is changeable.
Yes and no. We can describe the universe from the size of a proton all the way up to all the way out to maybe several billion light years into outer space. Everything in between, we have a very good understanding. However, at the edge, that's where all hell breaks loose. At the edge, we have dark energy, dark matter. We have the whole possibility of black holes. But in between, yes, we have a very good understanding.
In this room, we know the confines of this room. We know if there's a rat hole there, there's a bad joke there. You know, in this room, we know it. But when you step outside the door, we don't know what's out there. Well, what is that? That what's out there, the car can come crashing in here momentarily. What's out there is as equally valid to this room as this room is to there. You can't separate the two. So we don't know several billion miles out there. We know from here to several billion miles out, we know exactly what's going on. It's just, we know 3 billion, but 4 billion miles out there, we don't know. You see the fallaciousness of all that?
Right. So what's interesting to me, just from a point of view of, okay, I'm clearly never going to know any of the facts of anything. But what I do appreciate is it's sort of like you guys have the ignition key turned on of that sense of awe.
And that's it.
And that's what is a driving force for both of you. I mean, you're both, how old are you?
71.
But ask him why he hesitated.
Because I'll be 72.
Momentarily. Right after this microphone closes. He'll be
no, in a few months.
Okay, so you both look and act and behave like you're 23 years old, just getting out of school and about to begin this great adventure. Do you think it's like, for giving advice to me, someone who would like to live so enthusiastically, what triggers for both of you that sense of...
Buy my book.
Your book does have a lot of it, because it's story after story of when you have that... Off.
Exactly.
You know, many physicists come up to me and they say they do not believe there are aliens in outer space because the known laws of physics do not allow for interstellar travel. Now, my attitude is, if there really are aliens in outer space, they could be millions of years ahead of us, in which case new laws of physics begin to open up for them and become commonplace. Therefore, only with the known laws of physics can we say that we don't think there's any alien life out there. However, there's a boundary beyond which we're clueless. We don't know about dark energy, dark matter. We don't know about black holes. And the quantum theory holds everything together. And that's a mystery. And so what I'm saying is I keep open the idea that civilizations in outer space, which are millions of years ahead of us, could be using a whole new technology that we can only dream about.
And there's only another fact that you have to be aware of, that it seems that one of the imperative forces of nature is life, that life seeks niches of all kinds to come, whatever life is. On Earth, we see that everywhere. It doesn't seem logical that in a crevice somewhere near here, let alone the billions upon billions of opportunities that life has a chance to grow, that it isn't growing, and that evolution is like 1 + 1. It has to happen. If it's not working, it's going to die. If it's working, it's going to grow. It's as simple as that. That's evolution. So the evolutionary pattern has to work. So if something is bacterial over here now, in a billion years, it's going to be more than bacteria because of evolution. And from that point of view, I think the universe is alive, is a cacophony of life.
I mean, that could explain, like in Star Trek, basically, every alien you encounter is roughly our level of evolution. Is, you know, they're almost like humans, but...
You know what I want to say to you? Get a life.
Okay, when you said that in your SNL sketch way back in the day, and you were a Trekkie, and many people here were Trekkies, including me, did you get a lot of hate mail?
No, I said it.
There was no Twitter.
I may have. I don't read the hate mail. But it was meant as joshing. I heard they played on this day that I've been on. They played that a bit of that. We're going to leave right now, the both of us. They played that moment there. And I do say, get an apartment and get a, you know, look at the. It was meant lovingly, and I mean that lovingly to you, because you're awake with awe and wanting to know, and that's the key to everything that we're talking about.
Well, that's what keeps us going, the sense of the mysterious. That's what Einstein said. The most precious emotion that we can experience is the feeling of the mysterious. That's what keeps us going. Otherwise, why do we wake up in the morning? No, because there's a whole new frontier out there waiting to be discovered.
And you express this very well in the book, Bill, in the sense that you say not every aspect is going to be filled with pleasure. Like waking up at 5 in the morning to record a blues album might not be your ideal, but just the whole idea of here's this new mysterious adventure I can enter in at the age of 87 or at the age of 72. There's a new thing I can discover that is going to unlock some of the secrets of the universe. It's this sense of awe in each story you have.
I'm glad you feel that way, because that's the way the book was written.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Shatner, live long and ... What I learned along the way. It's a great book. There are many stories in here that are brand new. Despite 8 decades of people telling your story, this actually has some new stories that I had never read before about you. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Michio Kaku, author of a billion books, but The Physics of Humanity, I think, was the book.
Future of Humanity,
yeah,
right.
Future of Humanity.
Humanity in Outer Space.
Thank you guys so much for
a
coming
pleasure
on the show.
To be with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.